This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday pitch-in. Coming up, an attorney representing clients in East Chicago gives us an update on the Superfund cleanup there, plus some concerns about a proposed development on the site of the old West Calumet housing project. Later, education reporter Eric Weddle fills us in on what school reopening looks like, plus how districts have handled positive cases of COVID-19. And finally, as kids go back to school, how can parents identify and quell anxiety they might be feeling about this very strange school year? We'll get some tips from a professor of psychology from the University of Indianapolis. But first, a look at some of the Indiana headlines from this past week with our digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not going too bad. Let's start, as we have been for the last several months, with the numbers. Where are we at in Indiana?
Yeah, so as of noon today, 2,906 people had died from COVID-19. There are more than 78,000 confirmed cases and more than 886,000 Hoosiers who have been tested. So that's up from last week with 2,821 people who had died from COVID, which is a little less than 100 folks confirmed to have died over the last week. More than 72,000, an increase of 6, and more than 70,000 Hoosiers have been tested or have had their tests reported in the last week. So the important things to take away from those numbers is that new cases have again continued to climb. Last week and into the weekend, the state reported 4 consecutive days of more than 1,000 cases, all of them breaking previous records. Today, the state reported 1,079 new cases, and yesterday reported 1,046 new cases. So again, these spikes are much higher than what we saw in April. We're starting to see this kind of pattern of, you know, 1,000 plus cases reported in a day. We did a breakdown, actually, of how to interpret that data on the state's dashboard at coronavirus.in.gov on our Facebook Live this week. We spoke with the Regenstrief Institute's Vice President of Data and Analytics, as well as our State House reporter and person. I actually had a very thoughtful conversation about the difference between median versus mean this week, Brandon Smith. So you can find that on any of our station Facebook pages. Go to Indiana Public Broadcasting's Facebook page, or wait until I finally finish writing the wrap-up of that conversation for some of the breakdown.
All right. Good. Thanks for that update. And so we got was it last week that we heard from Senate President Pro Tem Rod Bray about school funding? And now this week, Holcomb wanted to clarify that, or earlier this week?
No, it was last Friday, which, again, feels like 100 years ago somehow. It's been a weird week. So what had happened was last Friday, Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray sent a letter to schools warning them that they could lose 15% of state dollars if they don't reopen to in-person instruction. So that kind of set off a bit of a conversation across state government. And so Governor Eric Holcomb and Republican legislative leaders decided this week that they wanted to provide schools with more certainty about funding for at least the first half of the new school year. State law normally restricts funding for virtual education. But Holcomb said amid a pandemic, he wants to ensure schools get what they need. Holcomb wants the State Board of Education to delay the required count of students at every school until December. So that would seem to ensure schools get 100% of the funding for the first half of the school year. But any further certainty would require legislative changes. Holcomb said that conversation happens when the General Assembly reconvenes in January. Now, State Superintendent of Public Education Jennifer McCormick said the Indiana Department of Education was informed of Holcomb's plan the morning before he announced it, and that her staff was still trying to determine the consequences and benefits of it. This kind of point in time count of the student population is an interesting solution to that problem. And she also said that it's just a delay that kicks the funding concerns into the next semester.
And we'll hear a little bit more on this with our education reporter from our flagship station, WFYI, Eric Weddle, in the next segment. But yeah, this kind of set a few fires at schools across the state. There were a lot of concerns from teachers and administrators about this potential funding cut.
Mm-hmm. I mean, especially with all of the different approaches that schools are doing and the way that they have to navigate based on the number of cases, you know, by county, it just is an entirely different ballgame for each and every school district across the state.
All right. We heard from the senior senator in Washington this week, Todd Young. What's the latest on the COVID-19 relief?
Yeah. So congressional Democrats have been negotiating with both the White House as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he couldn't get agreement within his GOP caucus for a COVID-19 relief package. U.S. Senator Todd Young said some of his priorities for the next federal relief bill include more support for the country's hardest hit businesses, telehealth and child care. He expressed some support for helping state and local governments fill holes in their budgets caused by COVID-19's disastrous impact on the economy. But the Senate Republican proposal doesn't actually include any of that help. Young said Democrats are actually to blame for the impasse, claiming they refuse to agree to anything but the House's $3 trillion proposal. However, Democratic leaders last week offered to come down by $1 trillion if Republicans met them in the middle somewhere. Young actually wouldn't say whether or not he thinks President Donald Trump's recent executive orders, including a payroll tax holiday, are legal, though he said they're not optimal. All of that being said, after he spoke to the press on, I think it was Wednesday, on Thursday, the U.S. Senate adjourned through September 8th without reaching a deal on coronavirus aid. That's less than 3 weeks. But in the greater context, fewer than half of the jobs lost in the spring nationwide have returned for folks making $20 an hour or less. So there's a lot of pressure on Congress to make some sort of deal. But it seems like that's just not in the cards for August.
And so where are Hoosiers? How are Hoosiers who are having trouble paying their bills? What's out there to help them right now?
Yeah, so there was Governor Holcomb indicated last week that the state has no plans to further extend a ban on utility shutoffs during the COVID-19 crisis. But more than 11% of Hoosiers are still unemployed, and obviously cases are still going up. Consumer advocates hope the state will give people more time to pay off their overdue bills. The Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor wants all state-regulated utilities to offer payment plans of at least 12 months to their customers. Spokesperson Anthony Swinger said, as of June, many people with bills more than 60 days past due hadn't signed up for payment plans. The Northern Indiana utility NIPSCO worries a 12-month payment plan for all customers would encourage some folks who usually pay on time to put off paying their bills. A spokesperson for the company said the company has already extended payment plans for its residential customers from 3 months to 6 months, and those receiving federal energy assistance can sign up for 12-month plans. However, on Wednesday, the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission ordered state-regulated utilities to offer payment plans of at least 6 months to their customers. Late fees, disconnection fees, and reconnection fees have also been suspended until October 12th. So all of those, you know, previous protections that were in place for folks are being phased out.
It'll be interesting to see when we get closer to that October 12th date, whether or not that will be extended. Thanks for that update. Mm-hmm. What do we know about the criminal justice reform plan put forth by the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus?
Yeah, so they unveiled an expansive justice reform plan Thursday that reimagines policing across the state. They had previously announced that the intention of this plan shortly after some of the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor or Drayshawn Reed protests that we saw not only in Indianapolis, but across the state. So their plan is divided into five pillars: save lives, hold accountable, empower communities, change culture, and improve transparency. There are more than three dozen proposed actions, including bans on chokeholds, racial profiling, and no-knock warrants, automatic external investigations when police shoot unarmed or retreating civilians, and requiring public hearings before police union contracts are renewed. The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus Chair, Representative Robin Shackle, said the agenda does not include, quote unquote, defunding the police, though what she describes is what activists call defunding police. There is part of that agenda, however, requiring the use of body and dashboard cameras that would actually require more money for police departments. But the IBLC plan also proposes decriminalizing some nonviolent crimes, removing police from schools, redirecting funding to treatment options, creating strike teams for nonviolent events rather than a police intervention, and restraints on the use of SWAT or paramilitary deployment. Now, all of these, a lot of these agenda items have been proposed in past legislative sessions and summarily ignored by Republican supermajorities. But Indianapolis Senator Greg Taylor said he thinks that things have changed, in part because of the increased attention on racial injustice. Taylor had spoken with Senate President Pro Tem Rod Bray about the issue and said Bray is hearing about it from his constituents that he represents in Martinsville. So Taylor's position and the position of the larger Black legislative caucus believe that Republican constituents will make themselves heard at the ballot box if Republicans don't listen to this agenda plan.
Okay. Well, it sounds like there is at least some communication going on with regard to that issue. And very quickly, how can someone join the Indiana 2022 way?
Just by texting elections to 73224 or finding us on our private Facebook group, the Indiana 2022 way.
And that's how you can tell us what to report on here at Indiana Public Broadcasting. Lauren Chapman is our digital producer. Thank you so much, Lauren, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, how is the Superfund cleanup going in East Chicago? We'll hear from a lawyer representing clients there. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Efforts by the EPA in East Chicago have done much to clean up contaminated soil and groundwater from a former lead smelting plant that was there for decades. But residents are concerned about a potential new development over the site of the former West Calumet housing complex. Mark Templeton is clinical professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. He's also director of the Abrams Environmental Law Clinic and is actively representing clients in East Chicago. Mark, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
So let's talk about the progress first. Can you sum up where we are now and what still needs to be done?
Absolutely. So you and your listeners may recall that in 2016, it really came to light that thousands of residents in East Chicago, Indiana, were living on top of a highly contaminated site where former lead smelter was located, the USS Lead facility that had operated there for decades. And residents and their children had been poisoned by the contamination left by that facility. Multiple times, blood lead samples were taken from children. And at certain points, up to 40% of the children tested actually had elevated blood lead levels. This is a public health crisis. And it took US EPA and the Indiana Department of Environmental Management years to finally start working to clean up the site. And that they have done since 2016 when this came to light. Most of the properties where residents live have now been cleaned up in terms of their soil. And that's real progress in the community. And I think it's really a result of the residents advocating for themselves for EPA and the polluters to act more quickly and more thoroughly than we believe they would have without residents' advocacy.
Is the groundwater safe yet?
No, not yet. And that is a lingering concern for many of the residents with whom we work. In fact, EPA recently criticized a study that was done by a contractor for one of the parties responsible for cleaning up the site. The report itself even identified that there were risks from non-carcinogenic contaminants there. So contaminants that don't cause cancer, but that can cause all sorts of other health problems. And while the report identified these problems, EPA said that the report itself was still insufficient in identifying the risks to residents, particularly in terms of children, in terms of the basements there. For those who are not familiar with East Chicago and the topography there, right, a lot of the housing there was built on top of fill on top of the dune and swale, so terrain there. So basically the water table is incredibly high. Whenever there are rain events, or even just due to seasonal issues, people get a lot of seepage into their basement, seepage of contaminated water, which can then leave residue behind. And so again, residents are very concerned about the fact that these groundwater issues remain unresolved. At the same time, EPA is saying, oh, everything is much better now in terms of the soil contamination.
So what about this rezoning request? What are these developers wanting to do?
Yes. So a group of developers came in and proposed to redevelop, to clean up and to redevelop the part of the site where the former West Calumet housing complex was located. That was the home to about 1,000 of the total 3,000 residents who live or lived on the site. And while the developers promise cleaning up the site, which is a positive, and promise jobs, many members of the community who still live on the site itself are concerned about the additional environmental challenges that such a development will bring. You know, these are large distribution centers that are being proposed by the developer, lots of diesel truck emissions, right? The residents have lived with the contaminated soil, are still living with the contaminated groundwater. They're concerned about what are these new air emissions going to bring. And so as a result, they have raised a number of questions and concerns. Unfortunately, the East Chicago Common Council, which is the basically the city council for East Chicago, approved the rezoning request a couple of months ago. And from what we understand, now the developer and EPA are in the process of hammering out the details of what the cleanup will look like. We, as the lawyers and the residents, are going to scrutinize very closely the details of the proposed cleanup, as well as what the operations are going to look like. And we're going to be advocating to make sure that real environmental and public health benefits are brought to this community, that it's not just cleaning up one former contaminating industry to bring a new one in.
Could it, though, be a good thing? Could it be bringing jobs? Could it be bringing, a little economic reset to the area?
Absolutely. It's certainly something the developers touted. I think that was really a consideration for the members of the East Chicago Common Council. And certainly members of the community are definitely interested in having good jobs in their community. I think what's important to them is that the community from which the facility hires is actually the affected community and those immediately around it. So the developer comes in and says, we're going to hire people from the community. But what is the developer really defining as the community? The residents with whom we work want to be sure that those people who have suffered from the environmental contamination are the ones who are really given the first crack at these jobs. So while they've been burdened in the past, they want to have first crack at the benefits that could be coming from redevelopment.
Mark Templeton is an attorney who represents clients affected by the contamination in East Chicago. He's also the director of the Abrams Environmental Law Clinic and a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Mark, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate it.
And now we're going to take a look at how Indiana schools are reopening. Eric Weddle is the education reporter at our flagship station, WFYI in Indianapolis. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how you doing, Matt?
Doing okay. Some schools have already opened. The rest are starting very soon. You look specifically at Wayne Township on the west side of Indy. What are they doing?
Yeah, so Wayne Township, you know, they're one of 11 school districts in Indianapolis, and most of the school districts there are letting students decide if they want to be in person or if they want to be in school. In Wayne Township, you know, they kind of have a few options, a few different things going on. So they're offering full-time in-person instruction for students in preschool through fifth grade. They can choose to go every single day in the class, or they can do online virtual. Students in grades 6 through 12, they're going to do a hybrid schedule, which means part-time virtual, part-time in the classroom each week. Those students can also decide to do virtual only at home.
How is learning then going to be different? You mentioned the hybrid schedule, virtual, in-person. How else?
I think the big difference, you know, is for in-school learning is just it's going to be a very different experience than what students, teachers, and administrators are used to. I visited Chapelwood Elementary School recently as they were preparing to bring students in. And, you know, just from the looks of it, you know, anyone could look at the school and say, this looks very different. Surfaces are cleaned off. Desks are spaced apart. There's fewer things on the wall, arrows on the floors, dots, different places, plastic sheets are up. So the environment has changed very drastically.
And along with that, there's a lot of new rules in place. What are the rules and how are they being followed?
So, I mean, right now, the state of Indiana really hasn't, you know, given hard and fast rules for schools to follow, but pretty much all the school districts are following a similar set of guidelines that are available at the federal level. From the CDC, the Department of Education has also issued its own suggested guidelines of classrooms, and then also local health departments are doing that as well. Marion County, the health department has its own guidelines, and it's also made recommendations that districts follow the American Association of Pediatrics, who've issued things. And so some of those are, you know, the issue of desks. You know, we've heard so much about social distancing since the pandemic began. So in school, some of these guidelines about having desks being at least 3 to 6 feet apart and students always facing the same direction.
How consistent are the rules across the state?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, since there is no like official rule, I think you're going to see a lot of schools following the same thing. I mean, these are now best practices that schools are following when you have these different associations and the CDC making these suggestions. You know, I've only been inside of one school planning, but what I've read and what I've seen and other plans that have been released by school districts, it seems that you're going to see a pretty similar look in classrooms based on what schools are able to do. Actually, last night I was walking in my neighborhood, and through the window of a church that's a preschool, I could actually see that they had separated their desks with plastic dividers, which is one of the recommendations if you're unable to distance students further than the 3 feet.
The state's given school districts a lot of autonomy, a lot of freedom, and I've heard mixed responses to that. Like, some people want more guidelines. Some districts like the autonomy. They like that freedom. What have you heard?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, you know, the guidelines of the classroom, you know, I think I really haven't heard much frustration in regards to what the different guidelines are out there for how to operate in the school. I think the frustration has been from the what the guidelines should be to just operate in general for in-person classroom teaching. You know, the big question around has been whether or not school districts should follow a particular infection rate, which is, you know, the rate of infection for people who have COVID-19 in their county. And some school districts have wanted the governor's office to mandate that, saying, you know, if infection rate hits X, say if it hits 10%, schools will go to virtual only. Marion County has put out some kind of guidelines around that. The mayor's office and the public health department has issued some guidelines. You've also seen some school districts as well. IPS, Indianapolis Public Schools, Pike Township school boards approved their own metrics for following. So they've kind of taken it into their own hands. On a similar note, we saw up in Elkhart County last week, there was confusion over their infection rate, which led to the county health director saying all schools should go virtual because of the infection rate. And then within less than 24 hours or so, it turned out the information was maybe not what they thought it was, and they let schools then go back to deciding what they could do. And that was a very quick turn of events that upset a lot of people.
Let's look at the front lines. Teachers, how are they feeling?
You know, I think there's, you know, different groups of teachers, you could say. I mean, you know, they're not a monolith. You know, everyone has their own thoughts. But I think there are some teachers who are very excited and eager to get back in the classroom and have that one-on-one learning with their students. You know, there's been studies done so far that kind of shows the learning that went on in March and April, May, when the pandemic started, just wasn't the best because so many schools were just doing all they could to offer virtual learning. There's also a lot of teachers, you know, who just think it's not safe. They don't want to be in the classroom and possibly be infected. They don't want to bring it back home. They don't want to bring it to their students. So you're seeing different voices that are being raised. The state teachers, one of the state teachers unions has, you know, said that they are willing to back anyone who wants to do a strike based on unsafe conditions at a school. It's kind of based on, I think, a lot of teachers' personal situations in terms of age, health condition, who they live with, and then also their own school situation.
Makes sense. What about school leaders, principals? What are they dealing with?
I mean, I think the principals are the ones that are trying to really, you know, make this all happen. When I visited Chapelwood Elementary, the school in Wayne Township, you know, the principal there, you know, she knew she had a lot of nervousness and anxiousness among teachers, the parents and the students that she was working with. And she was just, you know, very positive when I spoke to her about trying to do everything right. She felt the district had a great plan. She felt like her school building was ready. So she's just trying to like manage all these things that can happen. And at the same time, you know, when I spoke to her, classes hadn't opened, but we were seeing cases being reported at other school districts in central Indiana. So I think that that was on her mind. That's on everyone's mind. You know, what happens when you get to that point? And, you know, there are processes that the county health departments are putting in place. But I think, you know, the principals and those above them, the administrators, they're the ones that kind of have to, like, manage this whole situation with all of these concerns and all the other noise that we're seeing in terms of things online, the politics of it all. It's a burden for them.
We have seen a lot about positive cases, and there are a lot of different ways that school districts have handled them. What have you found?
We're seeing lots of different ways schools are reacting to having a case reported from a staff member or student. You know, we have seen schools already close down for like a week to do deep cleaning. We've seen schools switch to a hybrid virtual model, or we've seen schools say they're going to take off a few weeks. Delaware Community Schools, they've been going through a series of challenges. When there was a case reported in the past few days, they actually had 200 students quarantine from the high school after there was a case was confirmed. Right now, two elementary schools there are going to operate in person, but they are temporarily closing its middle and high schools as an effort to try and stop the spread of COVID-19. And then those grades in the middle and high school will do virtual learning through August 24th.
I heard a superintendent in Indiana tested positive.
Yes. So Terry Gooden, he's also a House representative, a Democrat from Caruthersville. He is the first known state House lawmaker to test positive, and also that I'm aware of, superintendent to also test positive. And he's a superintendent of Caruthersville Community Schools.
Has he been around students?
No, you know, he says, you know, he was working in a separate administrative building. He didn't have contact with teachers or students, and that he has been very cautious since he got sick. And he just basically says that this virus is real, and he wants, you know, everyone in Indiana to take it very, very seriously.
All right. Well, hopefully he ends up being okay. While I have you, there's been a lot out there about school funding. What's the latest?
Yes, last week, a letter from Senator Rod Bray went out to school leaders across the state and basically reminded them of the state school, the state funding law. And so schools are funded by how many students are attending your school district. And there's a certain day that those students are counted. And on that day, that count, it was calculated to get you your money. Schools that are virtual only, and this is traditionally like a virtual charter school, they're funded at 85% of the state funding level. And a few months ago when the shutdown happened, Governor Holcomb had said, schools, don't worry about this. We're going to have your back, and we're going to make sure even if you go virtual, you're going to be funded at 100% because we know there's a lot of other costs involved. This letter that Bray sent basically said, this law is in place right now. So if schools are going to open up and be virtual and they're going to only offer virtual classes on this count day, they're going to be counted for that and that they could receive only 85% of the funding. Well, as you can imagine, there was a very loud uproar among school leaders who did not think this was going to be an issue. Over the weekend, sounds like there was plans made with state lawmakers. And this week, Governor Holcomb came out and then he said that there's a fix that will happen. And basically, he's going to ask the State Board of Education to have a special meeting and to delay that date that students are counted to December. The idea is that schools may be back in session then, and they would get funded at what they're expected to be funded at. And if not, the session starts in January, and possibly there could be legislative means done. The response has not been very very positive from the educators I've talked to. Superintendent Jennifer McCormick released a statement basically saying that like this does really not allow schools to plan for the future. Like they need to plan for this whole school year. They need to know now if they're going to be funded at that 85% level or not.
Eric Weddle is education reporter for our flagship station WFYI in Indianapolis. Eric, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Up next, how can parents help manage all this new stress of going back to school amid a global pandemic? We'll talk with a psychology professor from the University of Indianapolis about the benefits of sticking to a routine and how to mitigate anxiety. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Going back to school can cause a lot of worries for children. How do we talk to our kids about it? What will keep them mentally and emotionally healthy as they navigate what may be one of the stranger school years any of us have ever seen? Here with us now is Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Indianapolis, Kendra Thomas. Kendra, welcome.
Thank you, Matt.
I think we should start by distinguishing anxiety from worry. What's the difference?
Absolutely. So worry is a lot more specific and anxiety is generalized. And so one of the first things would be to assess and make sure parents are accurately labeling the emotions of the kids. And so, you know, sometimes we think about anxiety as something so big and that can stay with people for so long. And a lot of people do struggle with anxiety, but we also don't want to get anxious about specific worries because those are normal, those are natural, those are necessary. And so if a kid has specific worries or parents have specific worries, that doesn't mean they are struggling with anxiety, right? And so being able to label things and will really help in dissecting and making sense of it all.
If we as parents, though, don't talk to our kids about their worries, can that turn into full-blown anxiety?
It can, and it can get out of control. Just like if we don't deal with our own anxiety, if we don't look at it and dissect it and try to figure out where it's coming from and what it's, you know, how it's driving other parts of our lives, it can wreak havoc on our own lives. And parents are in charge of helping kids wade through this. And so opening up the conversation and really dissecting it will actually help it go away.
And how can we do that? How can we dissect what's on their minds?
So the best thing is to let them ask questions, you know, and if they're not asking questions, because sometimes it's hard to get kids to talk, ask as open-ended of a question as you can, because it's really easy. And in children, especially the younger, the harder it is, but very susceptible to leading questions. And they'll pick up on anxieties that we project on them, right? And which is even worse. And so asking them very open-ended questions, or even better, asking them what questions they have. And then, because it's very important to be age-appropriate and age-appropriate honesty, right? Because we don't want to put parents in a situation where parents to say, oh, you don't have to worry about that. You won't get COVID. We can't make those promises. We don't know. And so very important for parents to be very honest in an age-appropriate way. And the best way to know what's age appropriate is to see where they're at. and ask, letting them ask questions. And then only after you really understand whatever the worry or the fear is, then you can phrase it back to them. Make sure they understand that you understood. And first make that connection. And then you can either explain why their fears are unfounded, or if they are realistic, because there are a lot of realistic things to worry about, to think about, frame it in a way that highlights structure and control. Because anxiety is all about uncertainty. Sometimes, often, the human brain deals easier with bad news than with uncertainty. Uh-huh. And uncertainty is what generates a lot of anxiety. And so any way that the problem can be framed to focus on the things that can be controlled will help diminish that anxiety. So not talking about it actually accentuates it, because it makes it more uncertain.
So letting them ask questions is a good way to deal with it. And then also asking open-ended questions. So now, what would be a good example? And I know age is definitely a factor here. So there's no magic Band-Aid here. But what might be an example, I guess, of an open-ended question you might ask to, say, a 9-year-old?
What are you feeling? What is it like to be back in school? Is it like what you imagined? And that's where it's important to let them take the reins, because we might think they're anxious or fearful because that's what the parent is feeling. That kid might be disappointed, right? It's not what they hoped it would be, or their friends aren't in the same hybrid schedule, or maybe this is a kid that's doing it online and it's a lot harder to keep motivation, right? And so not everything they're feeling will be worry and anxiety. There'll be disappointment, there'll be sadness, there'll be anger. And so helping them dissect that is also making sure not blanket label it anxiety.
Should we be having these conversations often?
Yes. A lot of what it is with kids is a lot of mini conversations, and adolescents too, right? You're probably not going to sit down and have this one heart-to-heart conversation, because this is an ongoing scenario too. And so a good goal is daily check-ins, and build that into the structure of your family. If that's doing highs and lows, right? That's an open-ended way to how was your day? Or build in the check-ins, because that's, you know, you might get a heart-to-heart conversation, and that's a privilege as a parent, but it's probably going to be a series of mini check-ins. And if you put that into the structure of the family routine, that kid's probably going to keep circling back to that. And that's what you want. So that kid builds that resiliency to all the emotions and fears and worries.
This is more of an issue when kids turn into adolescents. But what if they just don't want to talk about it? What if they say as much to you, I don't want to talk about it? What takeaway can we get from that?
Well, that's the struggle of adolescents. Right now, they're the gatekeepers of the relationship between parents and adolescents. And that try to provide as much support as that kid needs. And they'll probably circle back. Adolescents do. It's part of the normative phase of development. They go out and they circle back. If there's a good structure and a good support, a lot of support and a lot of structure, adolescents circle back. And in their time, on their terms, they'll circle back when there's a lot of structure and a lot of support.
What are some more common mistakes parents make when they're talking to their kids about these things?
Missing the age-appropriate mark, wanting things to be okay, and so kind of either bulldozing it with it's okay or projecting too much anxiety. So one of the things is make sure you're dealing with your own worries and your own anxieties, because if parents are dealing with their own, the kids have a chance of dealing with it, mm-hmm. right? It's much more likely that kids will learn to deal with uncertainty if the parents are also learning to deal with uncertainty. And so that's an important piece. Another piece that I would say is missing out on some of that structure. And so like I said before, the brain often deals better with bad news than with uncertainty. And that can look like screen time, right? And so screen time parameters probably for every family has changed because their schedules have changed, the expectations have changed, but having a structure is still very important. Even if it's more or different than what it used to be, different times a day or whatever the family rule is, having that is really important. So an example of that's it, no more iPad time, you've had enough iPad time, that's more anxiety provoking than having a very specific time to a very specific limit or very specific time, whatever that it the fit is for that family. And so that's kind of what I mean by structure, is it has to be something that makes sense for the family. But having those built-in structures that kind of serve as built-in disappointments for kids throughout the day can help them become more resilient to those disappointments and those limits.
We're talking with Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Indianapolis, Kendra Thomas, about mitigating our kids' worries and anxieties as they go back to school in a very, very strange school year. So what might be a healthier way to say, that's it, no more, if you're a parent and you see a little bit too much of what their child might perceive as a good thing? What might be a better way to approach that?
Make it very predictable for the child. Child knows it's coming, gets a lot of warnings, make it very predictable. And then throughout the course of that time, kids will learn to expect it. And that makes it a lot easier to cope with those disappointments. So making structure very predictable is helpful.
Can any of this apply to adults too?
Absolutely. We need the structure. We need this and some ways to do this. And there's just a lot of embedded uncertainty in this pandemic, right? If kids are going to school today, it doesn't mean they're going to go tomorrow either, because the school might have a temporary shutdown, but more likely because it's going to be an email that comes out saying that somebody tested positive, people need to quarantine or get tested or something like that, right? Kid wakes up with a sore throat because they would have woken up with a sore throat in any given fall. And there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. And education at its best is probably going to be a little off and on this season. And so that means how do you reduce uncertainty in something like that? Probably means having a lot of conversations of, okay, well, what happens if I wake up with a fever tomorrow, right? Who's calling off work? Who's our first call? Who's our next call? What do we do for the next 2 weeks? What happens when? Because some of the scenarios are rather predictable. And so having those open conversations before it's a time of a lot of anxiety, personally, having those preemptive conversations of here is our plan in scenario A, B, and C, and D, that will help lower the collective anxiety of the adult as well.
But if done incorrectly, or if done in a certain way, could having those potential scenario discussions also make things worse?
Could. Depends on how the adult is modeling the emotions in the moment, right? And so you have to make sure that conversation doesn't spiral into these worst case scenarios. It should be, what are the most likely, most predictable scenarios, and what would we do in those scenarios? And the kid or the adolescent might throw out another scenario. And the answer might be, well, we'll cross that bridge when it comes. These are the people we can rely on. These are the doctors that we can trust. This is what we're, and some of those conversations might end with, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. But as much control as can be modeled, even in the uncertainty, it will demonstrate leadership. And when the kids feel like they can't trust their parents, they're going to be quite anxious with that. And so being an age-appropriate honesty when parents tell them, oh, don't worry, you won't get it, you can't promise that. And if, you know, if the kid is picking up on other messages throughout their day, you want to make sure that the kid always trusts the parent, that the parent's going to, because that will help prevent anxiety from spiraling.
How important is social support right now?
Very important. And anything that can be done one-on-one will be, even if it's virtually one-on-one, is the best. And so we want to raise resilient kids, right? We want to raise kids that are strong, that can face uncertainty and be tough. And one of the things in the science of resiliency, so in psychology, actually studying, okay, well, these kids in these really tough situations, some of them blossomed. What made some of them blossom? And what science is really honing down in, surprise, surprise, is good adult relationships, is relationships with hopefully several, but even as good as one, can be a really strong protective effect against the troubles. Right. And so having parents can be excellent gatekeepers. They can't be everything for their kids, but if they can be good gatekeepers of strong adults, and maybe that's through FaceTime, maybe that's through a walk outside, whatever it is, that social support, be really mindful of the kind of social support that kids are getting, because social media might look like social support, but there's a lot of research tying it to increased loneliness, increased anxiety, especially among young girls. So being very careful, being very cautious about social media, because that usually does not act as a source of support. It acts a lot as a social comparison and judgment, especially for young adolescents that are just learning to put their voice out there and being judged by so many people at once. It's often not. And so keeping, even though it's virtual, keeping virtual interactions more one-on-one and trying to distinguish social media from social support will be a very important lens in parenting.
How might the pandemic end up making our kids more emotionally healthy?
So I love that topic. If kids, so there's so many priorities in a family, and especially if a family is cooped up at home with parents trying to work and childcare being off and on or school being off and on, there's so many priorities that parents are and kids are trying to balance. But I would advocate that kids who know how to manage disappointment and uncertainty, who know how to manage their stress and their emotions, they'll be able to catch up and handle troubles in the future. And boy, is this season really giving us a lot of opportunities for disappointment and uncertainty and stress management and emotion regulation. And, you know, if the kid doesn't really catch fractions this semester, but is really able to, you know, learns how to manage stress and how to manage disappointments, that kid's going to catch up, because their emotions will not get in the way. Their stress and anxiety will not get in the way when they have to circle back to fractions next season. And so not contradicting any teachers, by all means, try to keep them up to date, but the real work, there's work that could outlast this pandemic. And that's teaching them how to manage disappointments and uncertainties. And that goes for us as parents as well. If that's the skill that we can hone, we'll come out stronger, because we want to raise tough kids.
Kendra Thomas is an assistant professor of psychology with the University of Indianapolis. Kendra, great insight. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, get it wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe so you never miss a topic you care about. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana for topic alerts and discussion. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is All In.